All right. Hello, my name's Josh Polson. I'm the Program Manager for Linux Integration Services at Microsoft. And today, I'm going to talk about virtualizing Linux and FreeBSD workloads on Hyper-V, Azure, and Azure Stack. And so, you may wonder, what is Linux Integration Services? And I will certainly get into that. But let me start with Microsoft loves Linux. I have stickers, I have penguins, I have lots of things that say this, but our CEO said this a couple years ago, and we really mean it. Microsoft loves Linux. So you may say, how does that relate to what we're talking about today? Why do you need to hear about Linux Integration Services? We get it. You have Linux workloads running in your data center. We have Linux workloads that you want to move into a virtualization platform or from another virtualization platform or onto Azure. You run Windows, you run Linux, you may even run FreeBSD. You may even know that you run FreeBSD because it's running in one of your network appliances or something like that. And you want your freedom to choose wherever you want to go. Linux on Hyper-V, Azure, and Azure Stack is real. It's robust. It's a first-class citizen right there next to Windows as a workload. It's available today. It's been available for a long time, and it has all the capabilities that you want. In fact, the first check-in of the kernel drivers for Hyper-V that went into the mainline Linux kernel, the one that Linus Torvalds maintains, happened in 2011. When Azure went into preview, Ubuntu was there, and so were some other Linux workloads. In the grand universe of Hyper-V functionality, there's a number of pieces that go together, and we're gonna try to limit the discussion of this to the pieces that are focused on Linux Integration Services. So anything that doesn't require the guest's cooperation to work, to move things around, and all the things for starting it up and shutting it down, all of these software-defined networking and storage and other sessions that you may hear about, they all work for Linux and FreeBSD. And you can go to other sessions and learn about them, and they'll work just like they do for Windows. However, functionality requires guest cooperation. That's what requires Linux Integration Services. So I'll talk about, in this session, the enhanced management, dynamic memory, live backup, all those things that require the guest cooperation to work. So when it comes to running a guest on Hyper-V, there are a couple of decisions that we have to make early on. One of them is, does this particular guest that you're trying to bring in run on the Intel platform, AMD platform, x86, 32-bit or 64-bit? If they don't, you're not going to be able to run on Hyper-V. So if you've got an AIX workload or HPUX workload, all of these things that require ARM or some other chipset architecture, they're not going to run on Hyper-V. But, okay, so we have an Intel-based architecture. Do you have integration services available for that guest? If you don't, you're going to run in an emulated mode. Hyper-V presents a idea of a platform. And as far as the guest is concerned, it's running on that platform, and it doesn't know anything special about the platform that it's running on. So if you run Solaris x86, or if you run a version of Linux that doesn't have integration services, very, very old versions of Linux don't have integration services, or BSD with no integration services, you're going to run on that emulated platform. It'll work, but it won't necessarily give you the best performance that you could get. However, if you do have integration services, then you have all this extra integration with Hyper-V. You'll have the best manageability, the best functionality. You'll have performance that's near bare metal. And there are a lot of different platforms that have that. Linux with integration services, FreeBSD with integration services, Windows with integration services. They're all there. That's where we are. So what are integration services? Integration services doesn't just give you the basic drivers for dealing with the platform that was presented. You can get that in basic Linux. They are synthetic devices that present special capabilities. The guest OS, the rest of the guest OS outside of these drivers doesn't realize it's running with a special platform, but those drivers give you special access to the networking and storage and all the rest. So the guest OS drivers for Hyper-V are Linux Integration Services. And they are different from various platforms. There's different functionality and different capabilities, and I'll talk a little bit about what that is a little bit further on down the presentation here. When it comes to starting up a guest in Hyper-V, there are many different ways to start them up. One of them is you can use Hyper-V Manager to start them up, just like you would a Windows one. And you just right-click the guest and you say start. Or you can use PowerShell to start up a guest, start VM. Or you can use System Center VMM or Azure Pack, and you can start up a guest. And you can use the Azure Public Cloud's portal and start up a guest. And when the Azure Stack comes along, you use that portal to start up a guest. All of these different ways to start up guests in Hyper-V, just like Windows ones. Pretty straightforward. It's the same interface, the same programs, everything. When it comes to getting Linux integration services out for your version of Linux, there's a couple different paths that it can be followed to get it there. The Microsoft developers who work on those drivers have built a Linux integration services download that is separate from the Linux kernel, and you can get that from the MS Download Center, Microsoft Download Center. If you search for Linux integration services out there, you'll find a download, and you can download that, and for certain versions of Linux, you can install that directly. But there's another path, and the other path is that the developers working on Linux integration services submit the patches for those drivers upstream to the Linux community, Linus Torvalds and all the other people who maintain the Linux kernel. And they work on that, and they integrate. They kind of go back and forth with the developers, get some feedback, and eventually it ends up in the mainline Linux kernel, Linus Torvalds tree. And from there, the various Linux distribution vendors pull down those patches and integrate into them. We work with all those vendors to make sure that the latest versions, and the, most importantly, the bug fixes get picked up and put into their distro. And that ends up back on your Linux server running on your Hyper-V. Support issues will flow in the opposite direction. If you've got a problem with your Linux guest, you can go to SUSE, Red Hat, Canonical for Ubuntu, Oracle Linux, and they will support you because those drivers are coming from the main kernel that they support. And they can go back to the Linux community if they have some problems, and they can go back further. They also come straight to us if there's a Hyper-V problem, and we work with them to help with those problems. Let's dig in a little bit into the various distributions. Red Hat Enterprise Linux and CentOS are very popular, and we have Linux integration services support that goes all the way back to Red Hat Enterprise Linux 5.2. 5.2 through 5.4, there's actually features missing from the kernel that you won't necessarily be able to use, and it's not built in there, but you can use the LIS download a bit to get it. In fact, I have a whole chart here to say which ones are supported built in, and which ones you can download LIS for. If you download LIS, you'll probably get the latest support for all of these. The most recent release that's on here is Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6.8. It has the most up-to-date built in, but if you download LIS 4.1.2 for RHEL 6.8, you will get even more features that aren't available on RHEL 6.8. You may not see until 6.9, or whatever version comes next. CentOS follows along RHEL. It pretty much is the same thing as RHEL minus all the special secret sauce that Red Hat puts in, and then follows basically the same chart. Remember that if you download Linux Integration Services, you don't get the benefit of that support channel that we showed on that previous page. So let's talk about the download a little bit here. The LIS download supersedes all previous versions of the LIS download, as well as the built-in version. And you can use it with Red Hat Enterprise Linux and CentOS, like I said, but also Oracle Linux running the Red Hat compatible kernel. So there's two different kernels on Oracle, and the Red Hat compatible kernel is also compatible with LIS. You can either upgrade a previous LIS download that you've installed, or you can install it fresh over the top of the built-in stuff, but you do need to reboot afterward because these are kernel drivers. So once you install LIS, you got to reboot to make sure those kernel drivers get loaded. And there, I mentioned already that the reason you would upgrade is that if you want the latest capabilities, the latest bug fixes, although we work very hard with the distros to get bug fixes in, this is the way to get them. They're certainly not required to do that to run on Hyper-V, but you may get the best experience. Just be aware that it'll have an impact on your ability to get support from Red Hat if you install these drivers. Recently, we've added some support into the RPMs that we deliver for LIS to prevent incompatible upgrades. For example, if you do a yum update to and you update your kernel, obviously the version of LIS that you have is going to be incompatible with that kernel. It'll unload that LIS, and you'll have to reinstall it. Before, it would let you do that, and you would reboot, and then you would have a conflict between the current, the LIS download and the kernel, and it would cause problems on boot. So we've been working on making that work a little bit better. There are other Linux distributions out there. A very popular one on Azure is Ubuntu, also popular on premises. And we've been involved with Ubuntu since the beginning of the Azure preview. So you can see that the LTS version, long-term support version 12.04 is in here. And I list a whole bunch of different versions since then. The ones with asterisks are no longer in support from Canonical. They're end of life. But we did put built-in support into every single one of those versions. The latest and greatest is 16.04. 16.10 is in beta at the moment, so I don't have it on the chart, but obviously we've continued to put things in there. The thing to note about 14.04 and 16.04, these are long-term support releases. The LIS driver gets updated in what's known as the hardware enablement kernel. And that's a special kernel that you can download and they perfectly support from the repository. For 14.04, the version of that kernel is called LTS-Xenial. And Xenial is actually the name of 16.04 as well. So if you download the kernel from Canonical and use it, it'll get a version 4.4.0. So that's probably not what you expect because 14.04 started with 3.16. If you want the latest, greatest built-in stuff, you need to use the hardware enablement kernel. I also listed here SUSE Linux Enterprise Server, SLES. We've had built-in support there since SLES 11 SP2, which goes back quite a ways. With SUSE releases, their support for a release goes away 6 months after the next service pack is released. So that's why you see SLES 11 SP2 and SP3 here with an asterisk. They're end of life as well, although there are some HPC workloads and, for example, SAP that requires SLES 11 SP3. It's there, it's built in, it's just not as up-to-date as it is in SLES 11 SP4. We also work with SLES 12 and SLES 12 SP1. And of course, new releases are coming from SUSE, just like they are coming for Ubuntu. Oracle Linux, I mentioned a little bit earlier. I mentioned the Red Hat compatible kernel. We also work with Oracle to get features into the built-in kernel, the unbreakable enterprise kernel, UEK. So you'll see that there's built-in releases there for UEK. And then one of the things we added since last year was support for Debian. Debian was already getting some built-in support from the upstream kernel, but we actually worked with them on an explicit arrangement to get them into Azure as an endorsed distribution. So I'm adding them on the list this year. 7.0 through 7.11 just recently went end of life, but we actually worked on support with them for those releases as well. A lot of existing Debian workloads are going to be on 7.x. Debian 8.3 was the first release, however, that has Hyper-V daemons as a package. Hyper-V daemons provides certain functionality from Linux integration services such as KVP, the key value pair system, fcopy, which lets you copy files from the host to the guest, and VSS, which allows you to use Windows Server Backup to backup Linux VMs. On Red Hat, CentOS, on Debian, you need to load the Hyper-V daemons package. On Ubuntu, there's another package, and if you go look at our documentation, it'll tell you which tools that you need to download. So, you're thinking this might be a lot to remember. Now, the good news is that we have a TechNet page that has grids for every major enterprise Linux distribution, and what features are supported on what releases, and where you can get those things, and a lot of notes, and some exceptions, some best practices on all of these releases and how to get things. I provided the link here at the bottom of the page, but if you Bing, or maybe some other competing search product, Linux and Hyper-V, you'll find that very close to the top, if not on the top. So what's important here is it'll tell you which Windows Server releases support which features as well, as also which Red Hat or Ubuntu or CentOS or whatever releases support what features. It'll have links there for going and downloading LIS. It'll tell you which new features you'll get if you install LIS, and so on. That's great for on-premises, but what about Azure? Azure also has a page, and if you search for Azure and endorsed, you'll get this page, and it'll tell you which endorsed distributions are available, as well as a lot of information for building your own VHD and uploading it to Azure and setting it up so that it works well, which regions things are available, what availability there is, what sizes you can use them on. Lots of other information is available on Azure's documentation. What's important about an endorsed distribution is that it's available, already set up to be used on Azure. It's got the kernels you want, it's got the drivers you want, everything's all set up for you already. So you start with that, and you add your own packages on top of that, you're way ahead of the game. So, you may wonder, how do you know what version of Linux integration services you have on your system? If you do an LS mod and search for Hyper-V, you can see a bunch of different drivers that are in there. But you can also search for the RPM using the RPM QA command on any Red Hat compatible system. And grab for Hyper-V, and it'll give you a string there, and in part of that string, you'll see the LIS version. If you do a mod info on the kernel drivers that you have that are built in, most of the time it'll return 00 or 3.5, because when you get Linux from upstream, they don't let you put version numbers in there besides what the kernel version itself is. And when Red Hat backports that, they take the kernel version out. So it got stuck at 3.5 and it stayed there forever. But you can't really rely on that for what version of built-in LIS that you actually have. Instead, you want to look at the TechNet documentation at Big Grid and figure out where you're at. You also see 3.1 a lot. All right. Let's talk a little bit about features and capabilities of LIS. There's two different kinds of generations of VMs that you can run on Hyper-V. The basic emulated BIOS machine with IDE controllers and the SCSI controller is Generation 1 VM. This is what you see on Azure. This is the basic VM that you get when you just create one out of the blue. And then there's these new Generation 2 VMs that are kind of slimmed down. They use UEFI instead of BIOS. They delete a lot of hardware that you're not going to use because you're running in an emulated environment or a virtual environment. There is no possibility of emulating legacy devices. So if you have a really old version of Red Hat, it won't run as a Generation 2 VM. It can only run as a Generation 1 VM because it only has legacy support for that network adapter. Generation 2 VMs can actually pixie boot off a synthetic network adapter and get their image from somewhere else and boot from them. And also UEFI gives you the ability to do secure boot. And on Hyper-V 2012 R2 and Windows Server 2012 R2, you have to turn secure boot off because there's no support for secure boot of Linux VMs. But we'll get into the fact that Windows Server 2016, you can secure boot them. Some of the things that are useful, you can resize your VHDX on the fly, and then as long as you go into the partition editor in your Linux VM and tell it to notice the new size, you can crank away while you're running. You can also automate file system resize to match changes in underlying disks, but basically you can grow and shrink that VHDX, so you can grow and shrink your partitions within that Linux VM, and things are happy while you're running. There's a whole bunch of network acceleration that went into LIS. TCP offload went in a long time ago, virtual receive send side scaling, VRSS went in a while ago, VMQ and VMMQ went in more recently. These are all enabled by default in Linux distributions that support them. So if you turn it on in the host, the guest will notice and it'll use it. Some more management features. You can shut down guests from the management console. So you just right-click on it and do shutdown, and it actually sends the shutdown command to that Linux guest, and it'll actually shut down. All standard. There's some time sync protocol work that's been done. So when the VM boots, it syncs up with Hyper-V to get its proper time. It also does it whenever the guest resumes. We do recommend running NTP, or there's other versions of NTP like CronyD on Linux guests, because in a virtualized environment, your wall clock time and your hardware clock time can drift a little bit over the days, right? There's a key value pair mechanism for exchanging information between the guest and the host. So no network connections required. You just basically say, here's a key, put this value in it up to 1,024 bytes, and then boom, it shows up on the other side. For this, in Linux, there's a daemon that supports this, and the daemon's not necessarily installed by default. So if you're having problems with key value pair not working, make sure that Hyper-V KVPD or HVKVP daemon is running. The reason there's two different names is that some distros decided to pick a name based on what was coming from upstream and they made their own name for it. Other ones relied on exactly on what we submitted upstream and they have the name from that. Dynamic memory. So you have a guest and you want to make sure he gets a certain amount of memory. You can just specify startup memory and it stays there. This guy only gets 2 gig and that's it. But that's usually not very useful for folks that have changing workloads over time. And they instead enable dynamic memory so that they can grow it and shrink it as needed. So there's two different ways that dynamic memory helps with memory on Linux guests. One is called hot add, which will add memory to a guest, and that guest will see that memory and immediately start using it, allocate it. It allocates memory between RAM and maximum RAM based on the new interface here. On the Windows Server 2012, it used to say memory, now it says RAM, but basically it's the same idea. So that newly added memory increases the total amount of memory seen by that guest, but there is no such thing as hot remove in Linux. Instead, we have a mechanism called ballooning. So there's a driver that sits in Linux. When it finds a need to balloon down the amount of memory available to that guest, it allocates the memory to itself, and then it gives it back to Hyper-V. So as far as the Linux guest is concerned, your memory is still at the high watermark, but the balloon driver has taken that memory and given it back to Hyper-V. So instead you look at assigned memory in Hyper-V, and that's how much memory has actually been allocated to the guest. Let me try this with a graphic so you can see how it's going. So here's a Linux guest that's running along. Its RAM is at startup memory. We hot added a little bit more memory to increase the amount of memory available. Ballooning has taken some chunks of that memory and given it back to Hyper-V to lower the total amount of memory. However, as far as the Linux guest is concerned, it's still there where number one is. And then, yeah, that's basically it. So, which you didn't see there. Okay, so ballooning brings back some of that memory if the memory demand increases. So the balloon driver can also get the memory back from Hyper-V and give it back to the guest without having to hot add more. So when you look inside a guest, if you look at free minus M, and the reason I specify minus M here is because it gives it to you in megabytes just like Hyper-V Manager would, you can see the total amount of memory. It's not going to be exactly the same as the memory that you see in Hyper-V Manager because some buffers are pulled aside for like video memory and stuff like that. Those are taken out. But the total amount of memory and the assigned memory, the total amount of memory should just go up and never come back down. And in Hyper-V Manager tab, it'll actually tell you how much has actually been assigned to that guest and the memory demand and lots of other things like that. Let's move on to backing up a Linux guest. So the VSS daemon in Linux Integration Services gives you the same kind of backup interface as VSS. It's not the same as VSS, and the reason for that is that Linux has a file system freeze feature, but it doesn't have a way to tell applications that they need to freeze, to finish up their operations so that there can be a backup. So all VSS backups are going to be using this file system freeze feature, which is basically the kernel tells all the currently going on I/O to finish, and then it makes a shadow copy of that storage, and then it backs that shadow copy up. So this is not the same as application consistent backup. So anything that relies on application consistent backups is going to fall back to this file system freeze feature. Just like KVP, there's a daemon. It's named Hyper-V VSSD or HV VSS daemon for the same reasons as the KVP daemon being different names before. And the backup will skip over volumes that are not wholly managed by the host, such as pass-through disk size SCSI or SAN volumes. And that's because if the host doesn't control what's going on with the I/O there, then it can't really make a shadow copy. So let's go into a little demonstration or a visualization of this. So we fire up the backup utility. We tell the utility to back up our Linux guest. The kernel, the host tells the Linux guest through the driver that it needs to start performing backup steps. VSS does a file system freeze. It flushes out all the current I/O, kind of like the sync command. Then Hyper-V creates a VM checkpoint at that point and signals LIS to unfreeze. So that process for finishing all those I/Os, this takes about as long as the sync does. It can be imperceptible if you don't have a lot of workload going on at the moment. Then Hyper-V creates a volume shadow copy and backs up that volume. Pretty straightforward. So let's move right along to what's new for Windows Server 2016. Now, while Windows Server 2016 has been in technical preview for a while, and you may have heard of some of these features, it was GA'd today. Yay. Okay. Well, no yay. Okay. The first thing I want to talk about with Windows Server 2016 is another communication mechanism between the host and the guest. They're called Hyper-V sockets. So KVP lets you send back and forth a message that's about a K in length, and it's a little bit asynchronous. But Hyper-V sockets gives you a sockets interface between the host and the guest that you can talk over, just like a normal channel. But it doesn't require a network to be there. So no network required. And there's no restriction on message sizes. It's all based on the sockets interface. So I'm going to flip over to my demo system here. I'm going to show you this in operation. As it spends a little bit of time logging in. All right. So I'm going to fire up a guest here that has a client made. Okay, connect. There we go. So I'm going to fire up an Echo server. All right, so now the guest is listening on a socket that's coming from the host. And I'm going to fire up this program on the host, and it's going to send a message to the guest. So let's say this is a test. Nope, not there. There. This is a test. And it sends it over, and there it is, and it comes back. So that's pretty straightforward. Seems pretty awesome. Let's go the other direction. So I'm going to fire up a listener on the host. And I'm going to fire up a client on the guest. And for the sake of simplicity here, I'm just going to make it send some commands from the host again. I can send send a command to give me a directory. So here's a directory of home decwi, and I'm going to say, hey, give me a file. Git home decwi test VM agent. Give me a file. So I got a file. And just to prove that I got this file, I'm going to go to D. And there it is. It pulled the file across that quickly, and it's more than a K in size. So there's going to be a lot of things that can take advantage of this mechanism in the future. But right now, anyone can grab this. Right now, Hyper-V sockets is only available from the LIS download. It's a feature that is not yet fully in the upstream kernel. It's being worked up there. There's been some back and forth discussion about the best way to implement it. But you can still get an access to this feature using LIS download or by compiling it into your kernel. You can grab our LIS source code and build it in if you want to. So let's go back to my presentation. The next feature I want to talk about is the ability to hot add and remove a virtual NIC. So you've got a workload running along and you need access to another network that's on a different switch, or you want to add just another connection to the same switch. So pretty straightforward that, hey, we need more network capacity. We need to go talk to the network. So I will switch back over to my demo system and we'll show you hot adding and removing a NIC. So connect to this guest. And I'm going to use the watch command to watch the ifconfig. So what watch does is it runs the command every 2 seconds and it just updates the screen with that. Hey, I said watch ifconfig. There we go. So now we're watching the network configuration of this guest. We're going to go into the virtual switch manager. No, we're not going to go into the virtual. We're going to the settings. And we're going to add another network adapter. And we're going to put it on this same virtual switch that I have on the other one. And we're going to apply it. And on the other side, you see Ethernet 1 has already showed up, and boom, it already has an IP address. So that's hot adding one. Okay, we do whatever the work is that we wanted to do with this network, and now we're done. Let's remove it. We're going to apply this. Hey, this could cause problems with your network. Yes, we know. And boom, it's gone. So that's another new feature with Windows Server 2016. Let's move on back to the next one. So I already mentioned that you can't secure boot on Windows Server 2012 R2, but you can use a Generation 2 VM. With Windows Server 2016, another certificate authority has been added to the server, and you can actually use that to secure boot a Linux guest. The UI has been changed in 2012 R2. It used to be that in 2012 R2, you had to do a PowerShell command to disable secure boot into the Linux guest. That went away a while ago, and now you can actually have the same checkbox to enable or disable secure boot on 2012 R2. So just to show real quickly how to do that, I have a secure boot demo over here. We'll take a look at its settings. Look at the firmware, you see the shim is there for secure boot. We look at security, you see that enable secure boot is enabled, and that the Microsoft UEFI certificate authority has been selected. There's two different security authorities. You want to use the UEFI one in order to do secure boot of a Linux guest. So we're going to connect to this guest. It's not yet running. Let's boot it. And UEFI doesn't have a lot of the hardware that Linux expects to find, so it kind of skips through this stuff, and then it boots. There it goes. Pretty straightforward. There it is. So moving back to the presentation. I already talked about virtual memory in the sense that you can either have startup memory or that you can have dynamic memory. In Windows Server 2016, we have an additional feature called runtime memory resize. And what this allows you to do is that when a guest is already running and dynamic memory is not available, not enabled, we can actually change the amount of memory allocated to that guest. So I will pop over and we'll do that as well. So here's a guest that I haven't started up yet. We look at its settings, go to memory. It's currently set to 1,024 megabytes. So we'll start up with that amount of memory. And then we'll go down here, we can actually see the amount of memory assigned. Currently assigned 1,024 megabytes. So let's log into this guy. So I'm going to use the same watch command. I'm going to do free minus M this time, which shows you how much memory there is in megabytes. So notice that it says 963 megabytes. The reason that it's not 1024 is that some memory has been put aside for video buffers and other buffers. So far, so good. We have some new work that we need to do. Somebody's going to run a gigantic data warehouse query. We know it's going to use a lot of memory. Let's crank this up to 2 gig and apply it. Over on the guest side, you notice it popped up to 1987. Now we're able to do our workload and have that amount of memory available. Okay, so that executive who decided to run this DSS query is done. Let's get back some memory so that we can actually have more guests going. Let's go right back down to 1024. So down here, notice that assigned memory is 2048. Over there, it's 1987. We apply it again. Assigned memory has dropped to 1024. The total amount of memory, the high water mark, is still at that 2048 mark, but the amount of memory that's free has dropped down to 650. So the idea here is the balloon driver has gone out and grabbed all that memory and given it back to Hyper-V. So as far as the Linux guest is concerned, as far as the rest of the Linux OS is concerned, that memory is there. It's just allocated to something. It doesn't know what it's allocated to. But as far as Hyper-V is concerned, that guest only has a gig of memory. All right. Let's move on back to the presentation. So that was runtime memory resize. Same caveats here as there is for dynamic memory, that the kernel must support outad, and the balloon driver has to be supported as well. Next feature I want to talk about is discrete device assignment. Apparently very popular. All right, so the discrete device assignment was added to allow you to take PCI Express devices and expose them to guests. And it allows you to map directly to things like specialized NICs, specialized GPUs, and other devices. As far as the Linux guest is concerned, it uses the same device drivers as it would if it was on bare metal using that same device. That whole device has just been exposed to it. And so, for example, we use this on the N-series Azure VMs to expose the GPUs to Linux guests. PCI pass-through DDAs is a prerequisite for also doing another feature known as SROV, single root I/O, which allocates a portion of a special NIC to the virtual machine so they can talk to the NIC directly. This improves latency and throughput. There's a special driver needed for Linux known as a virtual function driver, VF. There's a special host driver needed for this known as a physical function driver, PF. And we're still working on getting those VF drivers into the upstream where they need to be changed. And the vendors are also working on getting the PF drivers for the host. So there's already several VF drivers available, a number of Intel 10 gig cards, the Intel 40 gig card, the i740, and also Mellanox. But the physical drivers also need to be updated. So like the next version of the Mellanox driver for the host is going to have the appropriate functions in it. Also, the next version of the Intel host driver for the 40 gig card is needed. So to show you this, I'm going to pop back over here. I'm going to switch to another program. Here I am talking to a VM that's running on Azure. And it doesn't look special until I say NVIDIA SMI. Show me my special NVIDIA card that I use for special CUDA compute workloads. This takes a little bit to run, but there it is. There's a Tesla K80 running on Azure in a Linux VM. So I can do all sorts of workloads with that. All right. So we spent a lot of time talking about features. And I showed you a few demos, but let's spend a little bit of time talking about performance and best practices. Linux runs well on Windows. Linux and FreeBSD guests are first-class citizens. If there's a performance difference between Linux and Windows, it's a bug, I need to go fix it. If there's a functionality difference between Linux and Windows guests, that's a bug, I need to go fix it. Linux The LIS drivers provide deep integration with Hyper-V, comparable with the same LIS capability, I'm sorry, WIS, or Windows Integration Services capabilities. We already support, I already mentioned the supporting offload capabilities on networking. I already mentioned that we support all the same kinds of things outside the guest. We support pass-through disks so that the guest can talk directly to a disk. We support fiber channel and a number of other SAN technologies. And now we have PCI pass-through and SRIOV to get even more direct route to the hardware, which is just coming online now. When it comes to benchmarking your workloads on Hyper-V, there are a few best practices that you may want to consider. A lot of people like to use Sysbench or iPerf, and those are perfectly valid tools to use. But for example, for networking, there's a tool called NTTCP, that's NT2TCP, that has been around on Windows for a long time. We've actually ported that over to Linux so that you can do interoperability benchmarks between Windows and Linux, or you can do Linux to Linux, lots of other different scenarios. And the benefit of using NTTTCP is that you can do lots and lots of threads to simulate lots and lots of connections that you'd be using to talk between two hosts. When it comes to doing benchmarks in a virtualized environment, it's always better to use multiple threads, use CPU affinity, use all the offload capabilities you can get a hold of. I put some links in here to the tools that we use. LagScope is a new tool that we've added also for testing latency. And what that's useful is that latency is a killer for single connections. And so we'd like to test that. On the storage side, there's a lot of different storage benchmarking tools, but we like FIO. And the reason we like FIO is that there's a Linux engine called libAIO, there's a Windows engine called WindowsAIO, and it lets us do comparative benchmarks easily. The trick on the storage side is kind of similar to the trick on the networking side. You want to produce enough workload, keep those queues full enough to really get a throughput number that makes sense. FIO is very flexible for modeling this kind of stuff, so if you have any questions about it, you can look me up. We can talk about your workload and how best to measure it. So keep the queues full, and you can actually see what kind of throughput that you can do on Linux or FreeBSD on Hyper-V. Let's go into a specific benchmark. 40 gig Ethernet on a local host. So we're talking from one VM to another VM over a 40 gig channel, one host to another host. Here I am comparing a Windows VM workload to a Linux VM workload. And as you can see, as I go further and further, number of TCP connections across the bottom, we get close to saturating the bandwidth available on that link. So we saturated right around 16 connections. Certainly saturated both of them as you get up higher. You compare that to bare metal. Bare metal, you'll saturate it with fewer connections, but you'll get to the same comparative level as you get up higher. So the thing to remember here is that you need to have enough TCP connections to really give it a fair chance. That was not with PCI pass-through. That was not with SRIOV. I have an SRIOV slide at the end because not many people have SRIOV available yet. So I was just sticking with regular VM workloads here. Sorry, we'll have more questions at the end, but I figured I better answer that one. All right, so when we switch over to going onto Azure, onto the G5 instance, which happens to have a pretty big networking channel on the end of it, you can see that Linux and VM workloads are pretty comparable. Linux does better out of the gate, but Windows catches up pretty quickly when you get up to 64 connections. I also included on the other side of the slide here a graph of latency. Latency becomes important pretty quickly. So when you get up to 512 connections, the latency on Linux is quite a bit higher than it is on Windows. And also the CPU load is actually quite a bit higher on Linux than it does Windows. So that's a thing to keep in mind. There is kind of a hump, and you kind of look for the sweet spot of the hump. Let's compare it to another cloud. Here's a 10 gigabit Ethernet on the D14s on Azure. and on a competitor's Linux over here in purple. We can get up to nearly saturating the amount of bandwidth once we get up to 64 connections. And then you can see that we kind of hit a hump. But on the other side of it, you can see that the latency goes up quite a bit faster on a certain other cloud than ours, but it kind of stays at the same level. Let's talk a little bit about storage. I know this is a little bit of an eye chart in this big room, but the idea here is you get the queues deeper, you can get quite a bit of throughput. I'm including here in orange the bare metal Linux number, and then yellow is the Linux VM. So you can see that the Linux VM is tracking pretty closely once you get it up big enough against bare metal Linux performance. The little dotted line is the amount of latency, and you can see kind of the latency is pretty much the same on all the various workloads. So I have reads here, I have writes. You can see that the write performance catches up pretty quickly. And then if we do the cloud comparison, you can see that the Windows and Linux VM track pretty closely on Azure, and then there's a competing VM there that doesn't keep up nearly as much. You can see the main reason is probably the latency. Let's talk about middleware, or more like applications that you might be running. So here's Redis with a 4K payload, and I'm comparing again Linux bare metal in orange, Linux VM in yellow, and now I've added a new piece here in gray, which is some patches that are coming down the road that are not yet available in the distros. On this one, you can see we're trying to catch up to bare metal performance, and once we get up the number of pipelines pretty high, that we get pretty good. And once you get past 64, though, the performance starts tailing off again. So finding the sweet spot is still an important thing, and then on bare metal, the sweet spot is not going to be in a different spot than it is going to be in the VM. But you can see that we compare pretty favorably with bare metal in the middle scenarios. Let's talk MongoDB. So here's a what's known as Scenario A with their benchmarking tool, which is called YCSB. The VM performance kind of drops off rather quickly, but we have some patches in the works that will actually get us better than bare metal performance once they get upstream and into the distros. So this one we're measuring, going across the bottom, the number of threads used with YCSB. And once again, you'll see a hump. Oracle makes a benchmarking tool known as Orion, and it has a number of different ways to run benchmarks. This one's an OLTP-style benchmark with small 8K reads. You see that bare metal performance cranks right up, and then kind of tops out. The VM kind of catches up to it once we finally get up to 16 outstanding IO requests, a pretty deep queue. But with these patches that we have coming down the line, it does a little bit better, catching up to bare metal performance. And then here's a decision support workload instead. The idea here is big chunks of IO requests as well. So as we go on up, you can see that bare metal and our upcoming patches pretty much track right along with each other, and the current VM performance with Ubuntu 16.04 lags just a little bit. And finally, you mentioned PCI pass-through. With SRIOV and the improvements in latency that we get from that, here's another benchmark where bare metal kind of cranks out, and you can see the top of the hump. With SRIOV, we get closer to catching up to it. And then with the current VM optimization the way it is, the other hump a little bit lower. So this is a total throughput on a number of packets kind of basis that we got through the system over a short amount of time. All right, I've talked a lot about Linux, and I'll also spend a few minutes on BSD. First of all, remember that FreeBSD is not Linux. While they are open source distributions, FreeBSD kind of owes its heritage more directly to BSD Unix. You can't use the Unix name because of copyrights, but nonetheless, there's a number of BSD derivatives, variants they're called, and FreeBSD is the most popular of these. They don't share the same kernel, but they have a lot of similar tools and a lot of similar story as far as open source goes. Between FreeBSD and Linux, FreeBSD maintains an entire OS. It's similar to being like a Red Hat or an Ubuntu, that it has the whole distribution, not just the kernel. Linux by itself is just the kernel, and then the distributions add all the other stuff that goes around it. There's only one distribution of FreeBSD. Linux has many distributions. FreeBSD is licensed under a different license than Linux, which is attractive to certain kinds of users because they can change that kernel and not have to give those changes to other people like you do with Linux. So there's a number of different versions of FreeBSD, 9.x, 10.x, 11.x, which will be coming out soon, and what's known as head, which is the very head of the tree for people who are gung-ho, want to try the latest, greatest things. FreeBSD 10 has BSD integration services built in, and there are ports available for older versions of FreeBSD, such as 8.4 through 9.3. FreeBSD 10 support had lacked the basic core support, but and has been supported on a best effort basis by Microsoft's customer support, but it has the beginnings of integration services included. When you get up to 10.2, you get most of VMBus and its handling of channels, a lot of the storage enhancements that were added to Linux, the KVP driver and the daemon, and then FreeBSD 10.3 has a lot of the networking offload features that being added. So large receive offload came in 10.3, a lot of networking stability features went into 10.3, but even 10.2 had some offload features like CARP and TSO, checksum offload. What's coming next? FreeBSD 11 is coming out very soon. It's going to have that virtual receive side scaling and send side scaling. Some significant work that has been done to refactor the networking stack. Also some improvements to storage functionality such as supporting trim and VHDX resize. Later on in the second half of this year, maybe into the next year, there's going to be PCI pass-through and SRIOV, and additional storage functionality and performance work, including the support for backup that people want. And more performance, always more performance. Next year and beyond, more interaction such as the synthetic keyboard and live backup support, and always striving to keep feature parity with both LIS and as well as, you know, Windows on Hyper-V. They are looking for feedback and suggestions. Here's a GitHub link here to go to FreeBSD on Hyper-V on GitHub and open issues or look at the code or anything like that. Now you wonder, how does FreeBSD get into my computer? It's a similar model that we had to LIS. The developers build BIS for Hyper-V, they submit it directly to the FreeBSD's foundation, it gets integrated in, and it goes straight into the BSD, either the ports distribution or into the OS itself, built in. So I mentioned network performance. Here's a throughput and a 10 gigabit link, improvements as each release comes along. So back in 10.1, you could get 2 gigabits per second out of a 10 gigabit link. With checksum offload, there's an incremental there. When you add the sender offload and large receive offload, it goes up quite a bit, and then some additional enhancements as you get to 10.3, getting all the way up to 9 gigabits per second. Here's a FreeBSD VM on Azure with virtual CSI scaling and a pre-release of FreeBSD 11. You can get pretty decent throughput with a significant number of connections here, and it starts to tail off there. Again, it's just, it's a hump. It's not as pronounced as some of the other ones I was showing earlier, but there's still a little bit of a hump. FreeBSD 10 is available in the Azure Marketplace, and so you can go grab it and use it and play with it. And it's not just for appliances anymore, or not just something that you have to upload yourself. It's something you can use right out of the box. Create a virtual machine, pulling that one out of the gallery. So, in conclusion, Microsoft loves Linux and FreeBSD. Do you believe it now? Have you always believed it? All right. So this is a good opportunity to do some questions and answers. There's a couple microphones here. If you have a question, feel free to come up and I'll try to answer some. I'll try to repeat your question, but... MySQL as a service? So you can certainly load the MySQL packages on top of all of these Linux distributions and use it. I don't know specifically of MySQL as a service, but I know there's marketplace images that have MySQL on them. Did I answer your question? I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't know of any plans at this moment, but I have to ask around to make sure. I'm sorry?
About the managed MySQL.
Management?
Managed MySQL.
Oh, managing MySQL? So I think MySQL database is something that can be managed in a lot of different ways, but you're talking about something that's managed by AWS? I'm not sure I answered that. So you have a question?
Yes, a couple questions. So the first question is, for the Hyper-V socket, it's very interesting. So does Windows Guest support Hyper-V socket?
Windows Guest also support Hyper-V sockets, yes.
From the 2016?
In Windows Server 2016, yes.
Okay. Are you aware of any like a community work in the like a Linux side, on the host side to support Hyper-V socket?
Am I aware of any community work?
Yeah, like on the Linux kernel side, KVM side.
I've heard a number of folks that have interest in it, but I haven't heard of any released products that use it yet.
My second question is for the shutdown and the time sync. As far as I know, the Linux actually, both Windows and the Linux has the support ACPI, which actually support, for example, shutdown. You can inject interrupt, shut down the VM, or like resync time. So why you develop like a integration service for that?
So yes, you do need ACPI, but what the services do is they do a clean shutdown by using the shutdown command as opposed to just an ACP power off, right? ACPI power off. Did I answer that?
Not exactly, but for example, for the start and resume, there's an ACPI button, you can say, hey, this is basically resync time between host and the guest. And I'm not sure why you need like any special service for that.
We don't have a special service for that, but what it does is it just kind of gives a clean interface for that. Mm. Also ways to fault the system and do kdump and stuff like that too.
The last question. For the PCI pass-through and SRIOV, if these two features were enabled with Linux, can we still like live migration to VM?
Yeah, you can still do live migration to the VM. In fact, we've submitted upstream a special bonding script so that an SRIOV interface and a regular network interface can be bonded together so that if you live migrate to a system that doesn't have SRIOV, it uses a regular network interface.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have got a question. The PCI pass-through feature, will that require any kind of special kernel drivers on the Linux, on the guest side for any operating system? Or is that something that would be, you know, exposed by the hypervisor and the the guest operating system will just see it as a standard, bog standard PCI device?
Yeah, there is a special, there's special work that's gone into the upstream kernel and has been working, it's working its way out into the distros. So Ubuntu 16.04 supports PCI pass-through right now. The next version of RHEL will have it. The next version of SLES 12 will have it. And it's, of course, in the mainline upstream kernel. So if you wanted to use it in Debian, for example, if you grab Linux Next, the mainline kernel, you'd get it too.
Okay, but it does require changes on the guest.
It does require, yeah.
Okay. So, and as far as that also goes, will that be supported in Azure as well for the actual PCI pass through? I guess.
Well, so I showed it on Azure on the GPU instances,
yeah, that's right, that was Azure.
But okay. Not every host on there is gonna have some device to expose.
Right. Sure.
So
okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
A quick question for Oracle Linux version 7.2. You say it has the LIS built-in for unbreakable enterprise kernel.
Yeah,
what version is it? Is it 4.1.2?
So UEK4 is caught up to the upstream Linux kernel as of 4.4. So Unbreakable Enterprise Kernel 4 for Oracle Linux is based on upstream 4.1, but the Hyper-V in it is based on 4.4.
So,
but it doesn't go beyond that because that's when we introduced PCI pass-through, and that requires significant changes in the kernel in other places. There's a lot of dependencies, so that's where they stopped on UEK4. When a new UEK comes along, maybe they'll have PCI pass-through in that one.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Yes, so the question was if you install the download of LIS, it has support implications on Red Hat. The reason for that is that anything that taints the Red Hat kernel makes it an unsupportable configuration, and they ask you to reproduce your problem on a supported kernel before they'll actually help you with it. So the kernel modules that are for LIS are different than what's shipped with a Red Hat, so as a result, it's not a supportable kernel from their perspective.
A couple slides ago, you showed the performance improvements in the networking stack. Is it just only applicable for Hyper-V deployments or Azure as well?
So the work that's gone into the kernel for FreeBSD or the work that's gone into the kernel for LIS? Because the last couple of slides was BSD.
I'm talking about BSD, FreeBSD.
So I think that's only for the Hyper-V drivers that are in BSD. So I think large receive offload and CARP and all those other features are already in BSD. Making the work for Hyper-V was the work that was done by the BSD integration services team. Any more questions? All right, well, thanks a lot for coming. There is an evaluation for the session available. I know there's this barcode on the screen here, but I think there's also a way to do it other ways with your Ignite app. And please let me know how you did. By all means, if there's any other questions that come along later, look me up and send me an email. All right, thanks a lot.